As U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza continues for 155th day, the death toll nears 31,000, mostly women and children. The spokesperson for Hamas military wing stresses priority to the striker-prisoner swap deal is to completely end the aggression. And Yemen's army announces conducting two naval operations against American ships and destroyers in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. Now, more than 5 months into Israel's genocidal campaign on Gaza, the regime's bombing campaign continues taking innocent lives in the besieged Palestinian territory. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, at least 82 more Palestinians have been killed and 122 wounded in Israeli attacks since Friday. A number of the victims remain under rubble of bombed-out buildings or are left unattended in the streets as Israeli forces prevent emergency relief workers from reaching them. Death toll from the onslaught on Gaza that began October 7th is now approaching 31,000. Over 72,500 people have also been wounded, while thousands are still unaccounted for. 72% of the victims have been women and children. Our correspondent from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah, Moti Abu Musabe, joined us earlier with the latest on the humanitarian crisis amid Israel's incessant bombing campaign of Gaza.
Well, Danny, actually, it was a horrific night for the Palestinian people across all areas of Gaza Strip, as this genocide is still persistent in different areas of Gaza Strip. Let's begin from Rafah. At least four Israeli airstrikes hit the residential tower there, Al-Masri residential tower. It was completely destroyed by those vehement airstrikes. Dozens of the Palestinian injuries were reported and transported to the Abu Yusuf al-Najjar hospital in the city. While in Khan Yunis city, the Israeli airstrikes continued against different parts of the city, particularly the western parts. Several Palestinian residential buildings were destroyed and leveled to the ground over those relentless Israeli airstrikes, while the Israeli artillery maintained shelling both the western and the eastern parts of the city. In the meantime, the Israeli starvation war is still persistent against the Palestinian children. It was reported that three Palestinian children were reportedly died of hunger as they were suffering from the malnutrition and the dehydration. And the Israeli insistence on preventing those Palestinian children from having any real access to their basic humanitarian needs, particularly food, milk, and drinkable water, leaving them in severe conditions regarding the dehydration and the malnutrition, taking into consideration the collapse of the Gaza health sector taking place amid this cruel Israeli assault on Gaza Strip. The real problem that the Palestinian civilians are facing here, which is about allowing thousands of the trucks and convoys crammed on the Egyptian side to enter into Gaza Strip. The U.S. administration and some regimes and countries are trying to overcome the main obstacle, and they are trying just to bypass the main obstacle, and they come up with insufficient, let me say, solutions in order to convince the public opinion.
Military wing of Hamas says the people of Palestine are facing unprecedented U.S.-Israeli hostility as the Gaza Strip is still under bombardment and siege. Spokesman for the Al-Qassam Brigades described Israel as an occupying regime devoid of humanitarian values, adding Nazi-like massacres are being perpetrated in Gaza. Abu Ubaida noted the international law is unable to stop Israel from committing crimes against Palestinians. He said rules of the international community are worn out and ineffective, adding those rules are at the service of hegemonic powers. He also touched on a potential ceasefire, saying priority to strike a prisoner swap deal is ending the Israeli aggression completely. Ubaida also referred to anti-Israeli operation launched by Palestinians back in early October. He emphasized Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was in response to decades of enmity and atrocities against Palestinians. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says the Israeli regime tortured some of its staffers to falsely confess links to the Palestinian Hamas resistance movement. UNRWA's revelations came after some employees released from Israeli detention reported having been pressured deliberately to tell lies. They were subjected to various types of torture, including waterboarding, to admit that they'd participated in Al-Aqsa flood operation of Hamas. Meanwhile, UNRWA said it will hand over 11-page testimonies by its staff to relevant agencies specialized in documenting human rights abuses. The regime had leveled allegations that some UNRWA personnel were involved in the October 7th operation, prompting Israel's Western backers to cut off funding to the agency. UNRWA has been a lifeline for millions of Palestinians since 1949, just months after the creation of Israel in occupied Palestine. An Islamic resistance in Iraq says it's carried out more attacks on Israel in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. The resistance group said it targeted regime's intelligence base in occupied Golan Heights. Another attack targeted Israel's oil facilities in the port city of Haifa. Group says it used drones to hit the Israeli sites. There are no immediate reports of casualties or damage from the strikes. In recent months, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israel's positions in occupied territories. It's also attacked U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Yemeni army spokesman has acknowledged two fresh strikes on American naval targets in retaliation for U.S.-British acts of aggression against his country.
The naval forces and the air force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out two specific military operations. The first operation targeted the American ship Propelled Fortune in the Gulf of Aden with a number of suitable naval missiles, while the second operation targeted a number of American destroyers at the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden with 37 drones, and the two operations successfully achieved their goals.
Saadi reiterated the Yemeni armed forces will press ahead with their operations in the Red and Arabian Seas until Israel halts its genocidal war against Palestinians and lifts its siege on Gaza. He also expressed gratitude to the Yemeni people for their demonstrations in the capital Sana'a and elsewhere in solidarity with Palestinians. Yemeni forces first launched operations against Israeli or Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea in solidarity with Gazans, and recently they've intensified their attacks on U.S. and British ships in retaliation for the two countries' aggression against Yemen.
Yemenis from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other major cities and chanted slogans in praise of the Yemeni army's naval operations. They also reaffirmed their full support for the Palestinian people and pledged to continue the protests until the Israeli genocide ceases.
The Yemeni government, all its members, its president and the people have one position, which is to support the Palestinian cause. We must thwart the American, Israeli and British project and stop starvation in Palestine. Our position is an honorable position, and our broad movement indicates that the Yemenis have great awareness, and God willing, victories for the nation will be at hand.
Protesters expressed support for the Yemeni army's naval operations against Western vessels, stating that the Palestinian cause helped the Yemeni people overcome the problems created by the Western powers in the country. They believe the conspiracy targets the whole region, not just Palestine or Yemen, and call on all Muslims to unite to thwart Western projects.
We went out today in Sana'a, as you can see, and in the rest of the governorates to announce to the world that our demonstrations and our position is a religious position that will not change with regimes or rulers. We will continue to insist on our position until our brothers in Gaza are victorious, receive food and medicine, and the U.S.-Israeli genocide against them stops. Our army will also continue its operations until the aggression against our country stops. Our operations are escalating, and upcoming strikes will stun both friends and enemies.
Our demonstration here in Sana'a and other governorates is to send a message that we as Yemenis have been able to overcome all the differences and problems that the enemies sought to create inside Yemen. The other message is that we continue to support the Palestinian cause, and what is happening in Gaza is shameful for all Arabs and Muslims. The operations of our army in the Red Sea and Bab al-Mandab are completely linked to what is happening to the people of Gaza, and the escalation of naval military operations is a legitimate move to support the Palestinian cause.
Recently, the Yemeni army intensified its naval attacks against American, British and Israeli-linked vessels and regional waterways, resulting in the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. It also attacked an American vessel, which the U.S. claimed led to loss of lives among the ship's crew members.
Yemenis assert that the success of Yemeni naval attacks, despite the presence of Western warships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, demonstrates the capability and high-tech weaponry possessed by the Yemeni army. They believe this achievement should inspire other regional forces to join the fight and support the Palestinians in face of the common enemies. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Thousands of Muslims have rallied outside the U.S. embassy in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, to condemn Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians and call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Carrying Palestinian flags and banners, as well as chanting slogans, protesters marched down a major street outside the embassy. Despite heavy police presence, they halted traffic along the way. The demonstration was organized by more than a dozen Islamic groups, which denounced U.S. support for Israel and demanded Washington push Tel Aviv to open more aid routes into Gaza as hunger worsens. Similar rallies were also held in South Korean capital Seoul in condemnation of Israeli atrocities.
This demonstration started at the Seoul Central Mosque as Muslims around the world are, you know, demonstrating in their opposition to the true genocide that's taking place now in Gaza, with the recent massacre happening in Rafah as people queued to receive humanitarian aid. This news is getting around the world and bringing people out in the street, like here today in South Korea, a country that really doesn't look too strongly at what's going on in the Middle East, and yet people are recognizing that, you know, yes, South Korea does have some involvement with countries in the Middle East, including a rather, you know, now contentious relationship with Israel, as it enjoys $4 billion in trade with Israel, as well as, you know, arms trade of tens of millions of dollars. Well, generally here, the government is trying to take sort of a middle course because, again, of its trade with Israel and its alliance relationship with the United States. Also, it relies, you know, at the same time on its energy security toward Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So the government has been slow both to condemn Israel and hesitant to condemn Israel.
Now, welcome everyone to our news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. A ship carrying humanitarian aid is expected to depart Cyprus for Gaza this weekend as part of a maritime corridor announced by the European Union. The Spanish vessel Open Arms is scheduled to head for an undisclosed location off the coast of Gaza. It will reportedly tow a barge loaded with over 200 tons of food. EU Commission President talked about the opening of the sea corridor during her visit to Cypriot port on Friday. President Joe Biden also on Thursday announced a U.S. plan to build a floating dock off the Gaza shore. However, it's unclear if there's a link between the weekend shipment and the U.S. plan. The expected delivery comes amid warnings that aid trucks must be allowed to enter Gaza in order to genuinely alleviate the humanitarian crisis there. UN has stressed land transport is the main artery of delivering supplies. The Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative says a plan to build a port off Gaza is aimed at diverting attention from the real issues that Gazans are grappling with. And now joining us for the program is John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Inderoy, Norway. Hello, John. Pleasure to have you here on our newsery program. Now, John, a lot of people feel this is too little, too late. I mean, Palestinians want this nightmare to end, not eat through it at this point.
Right. Well, yeah, this is, remember, Biden has an election coming up. So anything connected to the U.S. directly is part of his campaigning. And, you know, he the food drop, which, you know, actually ended up killing five people in Gaza because parachutes didn't open, that was a tiny, minuscule drop in the bucket in terms of what they need. And it's interesting that Western media continues to cover this story as if Israel is not governed by genocidal maniacs. The report at Politico or The Hill or Reuters, any of them, always say that critics are claiming Israel is denying aid getting into Gaza, but Israeli leaders deny this. Now, how can they deny it? How is that? How can the newspapers and media cover this story and take the claim, the Israeli denial, at face value as if it's at all realistic or true? This has been a genocide. It's an ongoing genocide. And things like building floating docks, a technology, by the way, that was last used, I think, in World War II, you know, who knows if it's even connected to the, it might be connected to the, you know, the oil field discovered off Gaza, but it's not going to make an appreciable difference in terms of the people starving right this minute. Open the gates and let the trucks in. That's all. There, and then, you know, forget the ceasefire, let's just end Zionism. I mean, more and more World War II Holocaust survivors are coming out and saying this is Nazi-like. Critics like Norman Finkelstein and Ilan Poppins that were saying this now is absolutely a Nazi-like genocide. They are perpetrating the most horrific massacre since World War II with the Third Reich. And 30,000 people, a lowball estimate, have died. Half of them are children, women and children, and Israeli leaders are saying that they intentionally intend to continue to shoot women and children. So, you know, these stories of an aid ship really, in the end, serve as distraction from the actual horror that's going on. It should never have gotten to this place, and we should not be seeing children in hospitals starving to death, dying of malnutrition, dehydration, and probably increasingly all the diseases of insanitation that are going to come with this. It is a nightmare. And one ship, great, I hope it gets through, but until the West wakes up, the general public further wakes up. I mean, people are overwhelmingly pro-Palestinian globally, but they don't fully grasp that this is a settler colonial genocide, and that Zionism itself is settler colonialism, and it's simply way past due to put an end to all of it.
All right. Thank you, John. Stay safe. Always a pleasure to check in with you. John Stepling there joining us from Inderøy, Norway, and that brings us to the end of your news review program. Everyone, thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Allah, Allah. چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah Allahu wa la ilaha illallah Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar
July 12, 1983 Place Hosseiniya Jamaran Tehran Subject Spiritual Purification and Focus on Spirituality. The contents of the mandatory prayer are also expression of glorification of Allah and takbir, and are eulogizing and praise. This is because that perhaps it wants us to understand. It wants all of the human being to understand that in the very first one, that you want to enter the greatest worship of Allah, you be aware that blessed and almighty Allah is greater than that, you worship Him.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back to Arab English Radio. This is the Spring of the Truth, and I am Bita, the host of today's episode. We're going to start with this sentence from Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its revolution. Today's sentence is, struggle for purification of ethics and encourage your friends to moral edification. As you know, the Amr bi Ma'ruf, Nahy anil Munkar, or persuading other people in order to do good deeds and forbidding them from doing bad deeds is one of the principles of our religion, Islam. And it is the most common activity in all social settings for sure. Sometimes it may be explicit, we argue for or against something, and at others it's implicit. We show interest or lack of interest. More often than we realize, we're engaged in persuading others or are being persuaded by them about big and small things in life. It's a very powerful force also. That is why that marketers yearn for word-of-mouth publicity and powerful media machines long for becoming the talk of the town. So, concerned with good as it is, Islam gives this tremendous social force a purpose. It must be used for promoting good, truth, and justice, and checking evil and injustice. That is the essence of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
صلى الله عليه
صل يا
رسول الله
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله.
The Quran declares it as the defining mission for this ummah. You are the best community that has been raised for mankind. You enjoin good and forbid evil, and you believe in Allah. At another place, Quran declares promoting good as an attribute of believers and promoting evil as an attribute of hypocrites. The believers, men and women, are protectors of each other. They enjoin what is right and forbid what is evil. On the other hand, the hypocrites, both men and women, proceed one from another. They enjoin the wrong and forbid the right. So, as we see, even in the Holy Quran, we have this tinge of Amr bin Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar, our religion and principles of our religion, which we saw in the speech of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, defender of Islamic Republic of Iran and the revolution, which wasn't only the revolution of Ummah, it was a revolution of hearts and souls. May Allah bless all of us and put us in a revolutionary form to the path of His satisfaction.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Yeah. every night and every day. Never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
Aperture.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions here. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917, when mustard gas is used for the first time, and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes, with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret. and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. Find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms. But some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thiodeglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater, to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Everyone
on
there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. But that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea,
and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth-generation fisherman on Bornholm. And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. And this is your host, Brother Mostafa. On this show, we discuss Islamic ethics and morality and what steps we can take towards reaching God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And studying and exercise and disciplining, these are all extremely important aspects of our lives, right? For example, if you're not exercising, then that can impact your physical health. If your physical health is impacted, then you'll have a more difficult time, for example, doing worship, doing ibadat and your prayers. It can impact your prayers. It can impact, for example, fasting. So having a really, really strong routine, which involves and balances all aspects of your life, is going to help you improve spiritually as well. It's not only about, for example, praying. It's not only about fasting. It's about having a well-balanced life, where you're healthy spiritually, where you're healthy physically, and where you're healthy mentally. One of the most significant steps that we can all take towards reaching God is establishing our connection with the Holy Quran. We have all heard how much we are recommended to read the Holy Quran. For example, we are told in different narrations that someone who doesn't read at least 10 verses of the Quran per day, they will be counted among those who are among the ghafilin, among those who have forgotten, for example, God. In the same narration, we are told we should be reading, for example, at least 50 verses of the Holy Quran every single day. However, what does it mean to really read the Quran? Sometimes people think that it is just reading the Arabic, you know, it is just reciting the Arabic. And, you know, that is a way of, for example, reading the Quran. Let me ask you all a question. Imagine that I send you a message on WhatsApp or I send you a text message and it's in a language that you don't understand, right? Let's say you're English speakers and I send you a message in, let's say I send it to you in French and you don't know French. Now, are you just going to read, you know, do your best attempt at reading the French and then, you know, say, okay, you know, I've read Mustafa's message, or are you going to at least go and try to translate the message or ask me, hey, you know, what were you saying? So in a similar manner, the Quran is a message. It's a long letter. It's a long book from God himself. It's literally the most authentic word of God that we have between us. Everything else that's out there is not nearly as authentic as the Holy Quran. So how is it possible that we don't make an attempt to understand what God is saying? It's a significant question that I would like to ask anyone who hasn't spent time understanding the Quran and its translation if you're not an Arabic speaker. We have to go for a quick break and we'll be right back from the break. And I want you to spend some time thinking about my question. We're discussing the steps that we can take towards reaching God, and the step that I'm discussing is our connection to the Holy Quran. So I would highly recommend that when people read the Quran, they don't only read the Arabic, but they spend time understanding what God has to say. When you start doing this, when you start reading the Quran with translation, if you're non-Arabic speakers, and you start understanding the meanings and you start thinking about them, what you will see is that you can start applying those meanings to your life. When things will happen to you in your life, you will start utilizing the knowledge of the Quran. So it's a way of connecting to God that will help you in all aspects of your life, in all of your interactions. It will also correct your thinking about many things, right? The Quran is a book which is extremely logical. It impacts you on a psychological and on a spiritual level. It will make you think and ponder. It will allow you to filter what's right from wrong. Many times, you know, even if you're listening to me right now, maybe I have made mistakes in my speech. Maybe other speakers make mistakes in their speech. The criteria that you can use is the Quran itself. If what I am saying meets the criteria and the way of thinking of the Holy Quran, but if it's something that goes against, for example, the Holy Quran and its meanings, then you can reject it. And this is exactly the narration that we also have from our Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, who have said that if a statement of ours reaches you and it is not according to the Holy Quran, then you can throw it against the wall. Right? That's an expression, an Arabic expression, to say you can reject it. But they say if it meets the Quran, then you can accept it. So that tells you that even when we're reading hadiths and narrations, they have to meet the Quran. We have to understand those narrations through the filter of the Quran and not the other way around, for example. So the reading of the Quran every day is not only going to bring light in your life, it's not only going to, for example, bring you rewards, but it's a way of really remembering God and what He has to say. It is also the words, you know, we receive these words from the Holy Prophet. So it's a way of truly purifying yourself that you will not find in any other sort of form of worship, right? All forms of worship are extremely important, but definitely reading the Holy Quran on a daily basis, making that a part of your routine, making that part of your practice, you know, setting time apart for that, and understanding what God is saying is going to definitely, how can it not have an impact on your life, right? Because of how deep the meanings of the Quran are. Now, once you've started doing this, right, once you've started reading the Holy Quran with meaning and you've started learning, you know, what it has to say, the next step, you know, that you can take is, for example, you can start looking at the tafsir, the interpretation of the Quran that people have written.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Oh, 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 oh.
Cause your love is all I need. To be all I can be. And I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need. To be all I can be. And I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
You know, when you read the Quran, not everything will, for example, will always be clear for you. A lot of verses may not make sense to you. And that's perfectly fine and normal. When that happens, you know, that is a moment for you to really go and search then for more knowledge. Start looking up, for example, different interpretations of what different scholars have said about those verses. And that will allow you to increase your knowledge and understanding of spirituality and God and religion. So don't be discouraged if you're reading the Quran and you don't necessarily understand many of these verses. That's a normal part of the process. That's a normal part of learning. So that's a normal part of learning that you want to take part in. I remember reading a certain tafsir and interpretation of the Quran, which itself didn't necessarily make sense, right? And that allowed me to then research that verse even more and start looking at what other scholars have said, and that corrected, you know, my understanding and thinking of the Quran. And the final benefit I would also add to this is that knowing the verses of the Quran and understanding it will also help you when you're talking to, for example, non-believers or non-Muslims. It will help you, for example, engage with them in much better and stronger conversations because you will be able to bring proofs, logical proofs, from the Holy Book, from the Word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's all the time we have for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows. Allah knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.